and is received back up at the same antenna, and then that data is used to make an image of the Earth. And so here's an image of Washington, D.C. that I got off the Sandia website. Here's a quick history. The invention is generally credited to Carl Wiley of the Goodyear Aircraft Corporation in 1951. And then in the mid-50s, the first operational systems were developed with Department of Defense sponsorship at some Midwestern universities and companies. And then in the late 60s, NASA started sponsoring work on this. So here's where the beginning of the unclassified work is. Classified work has continued, and of course, at least I don't know what's going on in that, and if I did know, I wouldn't be able to tell you. So that's the classified work is still continuing, and who knows what's happening there. Then in the late 70s, the CSAT-A satellite was sent up. There were some operational problems with it that caused it to only operate for 100 days, but the data that it sent back was so useful that people realized we have to do more of this. And so there was more development that was motivated by that. And then in 81, there is the beginning of the Shuttle Imaging Radar series. And now in the 1990s, there have been satellites set up by lots of different countries. Japan, Canada has a synthetic aperture satellite. In fact, on the Air Canada Flight magazine, there was a full-page ad for the radar sat. So here's a nice picture of Canada and a little picture of the satellite up there. So Canada has one. And then there were also SAR systems sent to other planets and moons of other planets that are giving nice images. So let's see. So here I'll show you a few more pictures. This is an example of looking at an oil spill from a ship in the ocean. I'll just go through some of these really quickly. And this is an image of the Gulf of Mexico. Here you can see natural oil seepages from the oil deposits there. Here's an image of the Gulf of Napoli, Italy. So here you have a volcano, and here you can actually see ocean currents. And here's an image of the surface of Venus. So here's a diagram of sort of how it works. So this is an example of the shuttle imaging radar. So you have the shuttle flying along with an antenna, and that beams down electromagnetic radiation that's focused in a beam as much as possible. And then the shuttle flies along, and the spot on the Earth moves along. This is known as strip map mode, SAR operation. There's also a spotlight mode in which the antenna beam is steered to keep looking at the same spot on the ground as the antenna flies along. And I'm not going to say too much about that, but you get nice high-resolution images from that. And here's an example of the spotlight mode image of the University of Michigan football stadium in Ann Arbor. You get nice pictures from that. Okay, so here's what I want to talk about. First, I think one of the reasons that there's so little knowledge of this in the math community is that for us mathematicians, we need the engineering literature. It seems as if the engineers sort of start in the middle of the problem, and we mathematicians trying to read this literature feels as if we don't really know what's going on. So what I want to do is try to explain things from the beginning so that we can understand this from a mathematical point of view. So the model I'm going to use will be based on the wave equation, and then I want to explain what the field sent out by the antenna looks like. So what field is incident on the Earth, and then usually a linearized scattering model is used for the interaction of the electromagnetic waves with the Earth, so it's usually a Born approximation model. And then the signal propagates back to the antenna, and so we can write down explicitly an explicit model for what the received signal looks like. And then once we have a model for the received signal, then we can work on reconstructing it. And it turns out the reconstruction method is a method that's called matched filters in the electrical engineering community, and it's the same as back projection in the tomography community, and same as migration in the geophysics community, and some people, Oliver was calling it the adjoint, and applying the adjoint. So it's all the same idea that most people here are familiar with. And then if I have time, I'd like to talk about what kind of resolution you get from this reconstruction method. We'll see how the time goes. And then I'll say a little bit about what some of the other cool things that the engineering community can do, and then some of the things that still need to be done. Okay, so the model really ought to be Maxwell's equations, but it's common to use the simpler scalar wave equation. And this really isn't too bad because each component of the electromagnetic field propagates according to the scalar wave equation in air. And so you have each component of the electric field is propagating according to this equation, and then it hits the ground, and then the polarization is important when it hits the ground. But then when the field propagates back up, again, it propagates according to the scalar wave equation. So it's really not so bad to be thinking about the scalar wave equation. And I'll be roughly thinking about the Earth located around the plane x3 equals 0, and then I'm setting all constants equal to 1 for this talk. So that includes factors of 2 pi and speed of light and so forth. Okay, so here you see some of the constants set equal to 1. So if the antenna were just a point source, then the field due to it would look like this. And you notice that 4 pi is now equal to 1. Okay, so here you have so if you had an impulsive point source, then that source would propagate out in a sphere, so at a later time t, the signal would be supported on the sphere t equals x, and then there's a geometrical spreading factor that takes account of the fact that you have waves propagating out on the surface of a sphere. But of course, the signal from the antenna is more complicated because it's not really a point source. And in fact, here's a diagram of what some of these, for one of the satellites, looks like. And here's the antenna that's being used. So it's a long, it's rectangular in shape, and it's about 10 meters long, 2 meters wide. So this is, by the way, at 800 kilometers height. Okay, so what we should do to take into account of this, what we should do is replace this delta function on the right side. So here's our delta function on the right side. We should replace this, we should replace the time-dependent delta function by some waveform that's sent to the antenna. And sometimes it's useful to write that in terms of its Fourier transform, for which I'm using little p. And then for some of the resolution analysis and some of the other things, it's useful to make a narrow band approximation, which is what most of the satellite systems are using, that to think of the wave that's sent to the antenna, that the signal sent to the antenna, as being a carrier wave, rapidly varying carrier wave with some fixed frequency, times a slowly varying amplitude. So sometimes that'll be useful. Okay, and then we should replace the point source, the point delta function, by the current density on the antenna. And for now, you can just think of this, you should think of this J as the characteristic function of the rectangle. That's a reasonable approximation. Okay, and then, so if you do that, then the field that emanates from the antenna is just the convolution of the Green's function with the waveform and the antenna current distribution. And so if you just carry out that convolution, you get some equations here. So I think it's maybe more useful to write the wave sent to the antenna, the signal sent to the antenna, in terms of its Fourier transform, so we get this kind of expression. Okay, and then what one usually does is uses a far field approximation. For the space-borne antenna, in fact, for all these systems, the Earth is really in the far field of the antenna. So we can make an approximation, we can expand this distance that appears up in the exponent by using the approximation that suppose we look at the center of the antenna, then another point on the antenna is much closer to the center of the antenna than the point on the ground is. So here's a picture. So the point on the antenna is much closer to the center than the center is to the point on the ground. So we can use an expansion here. Let's see, those of you who've seen this will be familiar with it. Those who haven't, all you do is write this magnitude as the square root of the dot product of these vectors with each other, and then factor out the large distance, and then do expand the square root. Okay, so what you get is the distance, the leading order term is the distance from the center of the antenna to the point of the ground, and then you have a unit vector. So I'm using hats for unit vectors. A unit vector from the center of the antenna down to the point of the ground. Okay, so we'll use this expansion up in this phase. Okay, and then what happens then is that you get a factor appearing here that's essentially the Fourier transform of the current density on the antenna. Okay, so that comes from this unit vector that you get. And so the upshot is that the field that is emanating from the antenna looks like this. Okay, now Y naught is the center of the antenna, and think of X as the point on the ground. So here you have the travel time from the center of the antenna to the point on the ground, and then you have this geometrical spreading factor, and then you have the Fourier transform of the current density on the antenna, and then you have this the Fourier transform of the time domain waveform that's weighting everything. So it's a superposition of these fixed frequency Green's functions with the antenna beam pattern and the time domain waveform. Okay, so here's sort of a summary. This might be sort of hard to follow, but the point here is that the incident waveform is this, I just said it's a superposition of these point sources, but you can also think of this as the same waveform that's sent out in the time domain, just delayed by the amount of time that it takes for the wave to travel from the antenna down to the point on the ground. And then here's the geometrical spreading factor, and this antenna beam pattern, which is... these antenna beam patterns are usually pretty constant over the frequency range. In fact, a lot of work goes into designing antennas for which that's true, for which the antenna beam pattern does not change much with frequency. So this is a reasonable approximation in many cases. Okay, and then if you analyze, remember I said that the current density on the antenna you could think of as the characteristic function of the antenna. So, and this is the Fourier transform of that. Well, the Fourier transform of a characteristic function is a sinc function, and if you analyze that sinc function, you discover that what's happening is the antenna is forming a beam, and the main lobe of that beam is perpendicular to the antenna, and then you can relate the angular width of that main lobe to the length of the antenna. So if you have an antenna of length L, for example, it was 10 meters for that CSAT satellite, then the angular width depends on the wavelength of the weight of the signal you're sending to the antenna divided by the length. So if you want to make a very tightly focused beam, you should have a big antenna and you should use high frequencies. So that's the upshot here. Okay, so that's the wave that's emanating from the antenna. Okay, and then now we need a model for how that scatters from the Earth. So usually in all the work that I've seen, one uses the Born approximation. So the approximation is you have an incident wave coming in, and then it's the scattered wave is proportional to the incident wave, and it's weighted by a ground reflectivity function. And then the signal propagates back up to the antenna. So this is probably familiar to most people. It's just the Born approximation. Okay, so if we use this incident field that we just worked out on the last page here, just plug that in. Let's see, and I also plugged in the expression for the Green's function in the time domain here, that is. If you just plug all that stuff in, then you get this expression. I think maybe I won't go through the details, but then one usually receives the signal back on the same antenna. So if you just look at this field back at the center of the antenna, you get this expression. So what we have here is we have the two-way travel time from the antenna down to the ground and back again. And then here's the antenna beam pattern and the Fourier transform of the waveform that you send to the antenna, the signal sent to the antenna. And then here's the geometrical spreading factor. You have two of these, one that corresponds to the wave spreading out from the antenna and one that corresponds to the wave that's spreading out from the point in the ground. Okay, and then you have this reflectivity function. Okay, so let me, in sort of a simplified form, you can write the data like this. Okay, so here's our phase that has the two-way travel time in it, and then here's some amplitude that has the antenna beam pattern and the transform of the signal and the geometrical spreading factors and the thing that we're trying to find. Okay, so what we measure is this integral, and what we are trying to reconstruct is this ground reflectivity function. So this probably looks familiar now, right? This is an oscillatory integral of the type that a lot of people here are thinking about. In particular, the techniques of microlocal analysis apply to this problem. This is exactly the same problem as a seismic inversion problem with a constant background. So it's actually an especially simple seismic inversion problem. We just have a constant speed, the speed of light in air. The character of the problem, I'll say a little bit more about this soon, the character of the problem depends on this amplitude here, depends on the antenna beam pattern. But if we take the simple case where this amplitude is just one, then this problem reduces to the problem of reconstructing the function V, the ground reflectivity function, from its integrals over spheres. Okay, so you have spheres that are emanating from this antenna for constant travel time, and you want to reconstruct the integral of the ground reflectivity function where it intersects those spheres. Or if you assume that if you do a 2D case and you assume that the ground reflectivity function, that this V is just supported on the plane, the ground, then you want to reconstruct this ground reflectivity function from its integrals over circles. Okay, so that's a tomography problem or integral geometry problem. Now, generally, we have a lot less data than we might hope. Usually, the position of the antenna just varies along a line. It's usually, for satellites, it's a straight line, and then you have data as a function of time. So that's a function of two variables. You would expect to be able to reconstruct a function of two variables, which is why one often assumes that V is just supported on a plane. Now, I mentioned that the character of this problem depends on this amplitude here. So let me say a little bit more about that. There are two main cases. One is the case where you have high frequencies. So this is the case where the satellites are operating. So you have microwave frequencies. So the wavelength is on the order of centimeters. And you can certainly have an antenna that has, for which you can fit many wavelengths on your antenna. And that enables you to form a pretty narrow beam. And so with these high frequencies, you can, even from a spaceborne antenna, you can get high resolution. The disadvantage is that these high frequencies don't penetrate foliage. And the military wants to know where are the tanks. They want to be able to see tanks parked under trees. So the military is very interested in looking at frequencies that do penetrate foliage. So they want to see what happens if you go down to lower frequencies. So a lower frequency problem is in the VHF range. So these are tens of megahertz. And for these, the wavelength is much longer, say 10 meters. And you can't really fly an antenna for which you can fit very many 10-meter wavelengths on the antenna. You know, the antenna for those satellites is just 10 meters. So in these cases, one can't really form a beam because you can't make an antenna you can't fly the antenna that's big enough. On the other hand, these frequencies penetrate foliage, and so there are some airborne systems that are looking at this case. So here's an example of one of the airborne systems. This is the Swedish Karabas system developed by FOA in Linköping. So here's the airplane that it's flying on. These are the antennas out in front. Okay, they're about 5 meters long. And the mathematical problem, then you really can't form a beam very well with these antennas So you are really reduced to the problem of reconstructing a function from its integrals over circles. Okay, so but for all these, for both kinds of problems, usually one tries to use an inversion scheme that's based on these matched filters. So these matched filters is you take your data, and then you multiply that data by the same time domain waveform that you sent to the antenna that's shifted by the amount that it would have been if the scatterer had been at the point Y. Okay, so why is this the... So this sort of corresponds to the field that you would measure. Sorry, I think you should look at this. If the scatter were at the point X, sorry, you assume that the scatter is at the point X, then this is proportional to the field that you would measure. Now, why is that the case? So we have an expression for the data, okay, that we worked out a few pages ago. And if you took your ground reflectivity function to be a delta function supported at the point X, if you just plug that in here and work out this integral, then you can carry out this integral, you find that the data that you would have measured would be just this, the signal that you sent to the antenna, the time domain waveform you sent to the antenna, delayed by the amount that it would have been if the scatter had been at the point X. Well, it is at the point X. Okay, so this P corresponds to the data you would have measured if the scatter were a point source, a point scatter at the point X. Then you take the complex conjugate and then integrate over all the all these variables. So this corresponds somehow to looking at all the spheres that go through, you're integrating over all the spheres that go through this point X. Okay. Now why does this give us an image? Okay, so here I've just written this P at this delayed point in terms of the Fourier transform. Okay, so this was one of the ways I said was useful to write the Fourier transform, write the signal sent to the antenna in terms of its Fourier transform. Okay, so this is exactly the same as I had on the previous slide, and here's the data. So if we take our expression for the data written in terms of this as this Fourier integral, plug that in, and you see then we have a time integration, and the only time appearing is here and here, so you can carry that out explicitly. So it gives you a delta function. And so what you end up with is the image that you try to make is the ground reflectivity function multiplied by some kernel. So this kernel has this kind of expression. This is what one would call the point spread function of this imaging system, or in the radar world, it's often called the generalized ambiguity function. Okay, so this involves the two-way travel time from the point X to a point Y, and it corresponds to the if you have a point Z on the image, then this corresponds to the two-way travel time from that point Z up to your measurement point, and this is the travel time from the point X up to your measurement point. And we can see if we analyze this point spread function, the main contribution is coming from the points where, so here's this point spread function again. So if you look at this phase, the main contribution is coming from the point X equals Z, but there's also another image point, another main contribution here. If this antenna beam pattern is such that the beams are just looking to the side of the flight path, then the main contribution just comes from this point X equals Z. Okay, so this is the case that Martin was talking about, where you have if you write this as a product of Fourier integral operators, you get this is the pseudo-differential operator piece, the part where X is equal to Z. But then there's another part, and if this antenna beam pattern is not zero over on this other main contribution, then this is important. Then you get this pseudo-differential operator piece plus a Fourier integral operator piece that corresponds to a leading order contribution where X is the reflection of this point Z with respect to the flight track. If we just imagine the flight track is straight, then these points are the reflections of each other in the flight track. And so in the language of Fourier integral operators, the wavefront relation here is a folded canonical relation. And unfortunately, the Sobolev smoothness, the Sobolev order, is the same on both sides. And so one of the things that we're struggling with is trying to figure out how to get rid of the artifacts that come from this bad part. Okay, and the artifacts are really there. Here's an example from the Karabas system. This is the low-frequency system where you really cannot form a beam very well. This is the city of Linköping, and you notice here's a transmission line, electric transmission line, and it turns out it's not there. This transmission line is over on the other side of the flight track. So this is an example of an artifact that one gets from that Fourier integral, extra Fourier integral operator piece. Okay, now let's see. How much time do I have?
15 minutes.
Yeah, okay, let's see. What I wanted to do was to talk a little bit about the resolution that one gets.
Is this really some of the two differential operator and the Fourier integral operator? You have two Lagrangian intersections there?
Yeah, yeah. So then the intersection corresponds to the flight path. Yeah.
So it's not really the sum of the two differential operator and the Fourier integral operator.
Okay.
Split,
yeah.
You cannot split it into two pieces.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That's right. Yeah.
The situation that David talked about.
Yeah. In fact, it's very similar to the situation he's talking about. Yeah. Okay. So I'm trying to figure out whether I have enough time to talk about the resolution. I think maybe what I should do is skip some of that resolution. I think what I'll do is I'll skip some of the resolution calculations and just tell you what the result is. So the resolution analysis in the high frequency case is done. Let's see. So you look at this. So here's your flight track. So here's your antenna moving along here. And if you have, you suppose you're able to form a spot on the ground. In the high frequency case, the resolution analysis splits into two parts, into a product of two factors. And one factor gives you the resolution in the along track direction. It's along this direction. And the other factor gives you a resolution in the range, which is the distance away from the antenna. Now, the resolution in the direction away from the antenna, in the range resolution depends really on the frequency content of the signal that you send out. That's sort of reasonable because the closer you're able to send out, the closer you are to being able to send out a perfect delta function, then the more information you have on the distance from the antenna. Right? If you could send out a perfect delta function, then just knowing the travel time would tell you how far away a given scatter was from the antenna. Okay, so that in the range direction, that resolution is just determined by the bandwidth of the signal you send out. In other words, the frequency content of the signal you send to the antenna. So the interesting part is what happens, how do you analyze the resolution in the along track direction? And so that it turns out, is the key to the synthetic aperture radar scheme. This key is to use the information of, as you travel along the flight track, use the fact that a given scatterer remains in the beam for several different positions, for many different positions along the flight track. So when you do that, you can work out the analysis. You discover that the resolution in the along track direction is, okay, so the result of the analysis is that the resolution is L over 2, where L is the length of the antenna. Okay, so this is a surprising result that the resolution that you get doesn't depend on how far away your antenna is. So a lot of these satellites are operating at 800 kilometers. You get just as good resolution at 800 kilometers away as you would if you were flying an airplane closer to the scene. Okay, so the resolution along the track is independent of how far away the scene is. It also turns out to be independent of the frequency. Okay, and it's also better if you use a small antenna. So when this analysis was originally done, these conclusions were so surprising that evidently nobody believed them. But over the years, people have learned now that these conclusions are there for a good reason. That they can all be explained by noting that when in all these cases, if you're suppose we look at this low frequency case at the frequency dependence. If you had a low frequency, that means your antenna beam is wider. If your antenna beam is wider, that means that a given point stays in the beam for a much longer stretch of the flight track. So the effective array length is much longer if you have low frequencies. Okay, and similarly, if you have a small antenna, the same conclusion happens. If you have a small antenna, you can't form a very narrow beam. You have a very wide beam, and again, a given point stays in the beam for much longer. So you integrate along for much, much longer distance.
Is the part in dissipation of the energy?
No, dissipation here is not being included, but the dissipation is really just the geometrical spreading. So there's a 1 over r spreading on the way down, a 1 over r spreading on the way back. Yeah. So
in practice, do you have any additional? I mean, the air might be wet or something. It might be raining or something like this. So then everything might.
Yeah. There can be effects that that's actually an area of current research that people are trying to figure out how to include the effects of weather between the radar and the ground. Yeah. So that's it's usually a pretty small effect though.
You actually assume you have one frequency only, right? You also assume that the highest frequency gives you the highest resolution, right? Is it?
Let's see. But according to this, the resolution is independent of the frequency.
So it doesn't make a difference whether you use just one frequency or many frequencies.
Well, you always need to use a little band of frequencies. Now this is the long track resolution. In the other direction, then you do better if you use a broader band of frequencies.
Okay,
so and then I talked about the range resolution. Okay, so when you do the analysis, what you discover is that that point spread function can be approximated as a product of sync functions. And the way you get the resolution is by looking at those sync functions. And here's experimental confirmation that you really do get a product of sync functions. This is the point spread function measured from the ERS-1 satellite, one of the European Space Agency satellites. And this is actually a measured point spread function. They use a transponder on the ground and make an image of what they get from that signal, and it looks like a product of sync functions. Okay. Yeah.
One question that I'm confused about when you look at the resolution. Mm-hmm. You talked about, say, a potential V of Z, but mm-hmm. isn't the Earth's surface something like a conormal distribution that you're really looking at, say, the topography? So how is that a function V of Z? Between which distribution spaces, or what kind of distributions are you looking if you look at the resolution?
When people do this standard imaging, they assume that the V of Z is really V of, say, Z1 comma Z2 times delta of Z3. Okay, so they assume that that it's supported on the plane Z3 equals zero. Okay, and that's actually a reason. If you have a pretty flat Earth, that's a reasonable approximation because the radar doesn't generally penetrate very deeply into the ground. So, of course. Difficulties. So the very next slide here is. So this is what some of the other things that can be done. So one is to use interferometric SAR, which means you use two flight passes or two antennas. The shuttle imaging radar actually uses one antenna on a boom. I think it's 50 meters away from the shuttle. For the other satellites, they just wait until the satellite passes around, passes over the same scene again, maybe a month later. And from those two flight passes, they're able to get topographic information. Okay, so this is the question about the topography. They're also able to look at changes in the Earth. And here's a picture of some of the... So here's a picture of a glacier. And these are interference fringes generated from the changes that in this glacier between the two times when images like this were made. Okay, so you get interference fringes from looking at complex images. Okay, you're taking into account of the phase, the change in phase between the two times when the SAR went past. Okay, then they can also use polarimetric SAR, so using the full Maxwell equations. So that's essentially a question of building antennas that are polarimetric. So here's a picture of an ice scene. This is sea ice with one polarization and a different polarization. So you get different information from the two polarizations, or at least you get different pictures. It's not exactly clear what information this contains. Okay, so we can do polarimetric SAR. Then the military is very interested in seeing things that are moving. Now, things that are moving are a little bit of a problem with the standard image reconstructions, because the image formation process depends on sort of coherent summing. So if you have, so the image formation process depends on a scatter being in the same location as the antenna looks at it from different locations. But what if that object has moved? Well, then there are some techniques that they can use to see moving targets that usually involve taking an image and then looking at a very short time delay later, making another image and comparing them. Okay, the same thing can be done to look at waves in the ocean. There's a wave mode for these synthetic aperture radars. They, again, make an image using a sub-aperture, using a small section of the flight track, and then compare that to an image they make using another small section of the flight track that's a little bit later, and they look at the difference between those. So using that, they can actually get motion of the waves in the ocean, and then from that get wind speed. So here's a diagram of the different operating modes for the planned Envisat satellite, which is supposed to be launched in October, that has various different modes in which it can operate. Sometimes they use some sub-images and are processed. You compare these sub-images in different ways to get, say, polarimetric information. Here's the wave mode that gives different kinds of information. Okay, so what's happening now? So there's research going on in the foliage penetrating SAR area, and I think I already mentioned that here you need to use low frequencies and your antennas have poor directionality, and so it's more of a tomographic image formation process, and they're looking for tanks under trees. This foliage penetrating SAR is also of interest to the forest industry. People want to know what's the biomass of the forest. They want to know how many trees there are, what size those trees are, whether the trees are healthy. Okay, then there's a lot of interest in ground penetrating radar. One of the big applications is in detecting landmines, which is a huge problem in many areas of the world. And unexploded ordnance, UXO, to identify old bombing ranges and try to clean up some of these bombing ranges so that it can be put to other use. There's also interest in current research in ultra-wideband synthetic aperture radar, where you have a very broad frequency range of the signals. And so some of this one approximation that I mentioned of having a narrow band, the almost a constant frequency, is not valid. Okay, another case, some other things that need to be done are better modeling of the scattering process. For example, R.J. Nachman at the U.S. Air Force Office of Scientific Research is pushing the idea for foliage penetrating radar that the foliage canopy contains a lot of water, and water is dispersive in the sense that different frequencies course, that waves propagate with different speeds at different frequencies. Okay, so the for dispersive media, electromagnetic waves, or in any waves in dispersive media, involve precursors in which you, if you send in a pulse into a dispersive medium, then what you see is you see pulses with rapid oscillations, a Sommerfeld precursor, and then you see a Brillouin precursor that come in ahead of the main pulse. His suggestion is that since these precursors propagate into a dispersive medium and these are rapidly oscillating, maybe these rapid oscillations could be used to get high resolution images under the foliage canopy. Nobody knows whether that's going to work or not. Okay, and then multiple scattering is a big problem. One of the strongest scattering mechanisms for forest regions is you have wave coming down that hits the earth and then bounces, hits a tree trunk, and then is reflected back. You notice the radars only measure backscatter data, and this is giving you essentially a strong backscattering return. These dihedral scatterers, these right angle scatterers, are believed to be one of the main mechanisms for scattering from forested areas. And that's not included in the Born approximation. So that's a problem. Another case that they would like to look at is if you have airplanes sitting on a runway, you have sort of a waveguide underneath the airplane. The waves come in, bounce many times, and then come back. These multiple bounces are not included in the modeling that we're doing for the Born approximation. And for the landmine problem, one of the difficulties is that the wave propagation in soil is very complicated because soil has rocks and animal burrows and roots and all sorts of things in it, and one would like to be able to distinguish scattering from those things from scattering from a landmine, and that's a very difficult problem. There's a lot of work going on in the image interpretation area. People get these images and they want to know, well, so how deep is the ice? Does that mean I can send a ship through there? They want to know what kind of trees are growing in certain regions that are shown in the images. What's the effect of surface roughness in the images? The military wants to be able to automatically classify objects in the images. In particular, they want to know whether things are trucks or tanks. And then there's a lot of interest now in the sensor fusion problem. Now, let's see, Larry Lyons used a different terminology for this sensor fusion, but it's the idea of combining information from different sensors. For example, in different frequency bands, you get different pictures. I have some examples of this. So, for example, here is a region near England taken with three different frequency bands for the same image. Okay, so this is a lower frequency, higher, and still higher. And, well, from these three images, can one determine what these crops are? Well, what's actually growing there? Here's an image of a place near Germany. Again, at these three different frequency bands. So what information is in these three images? It's difficult to say. Here's a example of ice, again from the same three frequency bands. So what information is that giving you? Okay. Let's see. And then there are some theoretical questions that I think the math community the math community can look at all these questions, but here are some that probably only the math community can look at. One is a uniqueness theorem for backscattering. That's still unknown for the wave equation. Then the reconstruction for the full nonlinear inverse problem, especially with this limited aperture data. And the engineering work is always in the time domain. The mathematical work in the time domain often does not include dispersion, meaning that different frequencies correspond to have different sound speeds or different wave propagation speeds. And that's a disadvantage of the mathematical work, that In fact, the fact that we're not thinking about dispersive media causes some of the engineering community not to take the mathematics work seriously. Another interesting question is, what's the best possible resolution one could get in these images? Now, a lot of these images have a sort of a grainy appearance that's known as speckle, and that graininess comes from scatters that are smaller than the resolution cell. So that's not noise. Can one use that to get better resolution, get more information about what's in the scene? And then another question that we might be able to contribute to is, what are the theoretical limits of these scattering, this imaging process? In other words, what cannot be done? The engineering community would find that kind of information very useful. Okay, I'll stop there. Thanks for listening.
Any questions or comments?
If I understood your talk correctly, you didn't include Doppler shifting in your analysis. Is that the nonlinear stuff you were referring to?
No. Now, in the analysis of the synthetic aperture radar, the term Doppler is often used to refer to the long track direction. Now, it's not actually a Doppler shift that's being used. Now, when I was first learning about this, you know, some of the explanations do involve a Doppler shift, but there's a synthetic aperture radar installation at the Army Research Facility in Virginia, I guess, that they have a synthetic aperture radar that's mounted on the top of a building. And so they have a boom up here that has a radar that's looking down to near the side of the building. And they're making synthetic aperture radar images from this installation, but the radar takes 8 hours to travel from one end of the building to the other. And so, you know, I asked these people, well, how can you get Doppler information if it takes 8 hours? And they said, oh, no, it's just phase. So the key thing is to keep track of the phase as you move along here. That's often referred to as the Doppler direction, because there is an interpretation. If one looks at this phase interpretation the right way, it's possible to think of that as sort of a Doppler shift. But I think that's really not the right way to think of it for these applications.
So you're saying, okay, I understand you can do it without, if you have a very slow-moving object, that's fine. But if you do have, say, a spacecraft flying over the ground, you do have a lot more substantial frequency shift.
Yeah, but it turns out that that's negligible.
So.
Yeah. It turns out that what's really important is to keep track of the phase changes as you move along. So what's usually the approximation that's usually used here is a start-stop approximation, which is the one I was using. That you assume that the spacecraft is stationary, and then you make a measurement. You know, the speed of light is really fast compared to the movement of the airplane or the satellite, and then so it makes a measurement, moves to the next location, makes another measurement, moves. So it's not really a Doppler shift that you're getting. So.
Any other questions? Yeah, question. The images that you were showing were not B. You were showing... Okay, you were showing some pictures, yeah? Mm-hmm. So you have an equation that was I equal to some kind of B.
Yeah.
You were showing B or I?
That's I, yeah. So the image, so these pictures, like this, for example, are the image that is made from the synthetic aperture radar.
Can you deconvolve this generalized ambiguity function? Can you remove it, like in astronomy? Can you make sense of it or not?
Well, that's sort of the goal of the imaging process, is, you know, forming this.
This function is still there, yeah?
Right, that's right.
The organization method to try to remove it, like an image.
Let's see.
Right, astronomy.
Yeah, if one knows what the what that function is, maybe one can. Yeah, let's see. I don't know. That sounds like a very reasonable idea, but I'm sure that something like that would already be being done in the engineering community if it works. Yeah. So, yeah, there are a lot of smart engineers. So,
Actually, it was first.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I have question about your issue on uniqueness. If you mentioned you want to relate it to the seismic problem, in fact, Fabia Rocca worked on synthetic aperture radar, if I recall.
Right. Yeah. So
years ago in a European project.
Yeah. Now some of these techniques from the geophysics world are making their way into the radar community. That's right.
But if I recall what he was doing or what the issue was there, and again, I'm not completely familiar with it, is what you really do in terms of addressing uniqueness issues. You combine many lines of data acquisition. You consider that as one data set in the inverse problem.
Oh, so you're talking about many flight tracks. So if you have many flight tracks, then you could do that.
You combine all those data, then you really have what they call the zero offset seismic experiment. And if you have a constant background medium, there are uniqueness results for that case. Now, is your uniqueness problem related to the fact that you cannot create, say, a dense grid of flight paths?
Now, all the work being done in this SAR world is all based on the Born approximation.
Even in the Born approximation. My question
is... is this uniqueness for the Born approximation, or is this... So the uniqueness issue I want to bring out is, what happens if you don't make the Born approximation?
But what other approximation are you thinking of? Or you want to take into account the multiple scattering?
One would like to take into account multiple scattering. That's a hard problem. If you make a linearized approximation, then there are a lot of things you can do. Some work's been done on that.
I just have a general kind of philosophical question about the role of mathematicians in those problems. I mean, as you commented, lots of smart engineers. And the stuff that you presented, of course, it was very clearly presented, but if you attended a graduate course and looked through engineering or something, you'd see all this stuff. So it's not as if engineers don't know about the material you presented. And I'm just wondering, and I'm thinking also of this issue of uniqueness. I mean, engineers have made these images, the lovely images you show, without knowing or worrying about the uniqueness so much. I'm just wondering where you think the role of mathematicians really is in this thing. And I'm sometimes pessimistic about what we can actually contribute, and I'm wondering what...
Yeah.
Is anybody here from the funding agency?
Well, actually, I think there's a lot that mathematicians should be able to contribute. Because as you can see from this presentation, the key technology here is really mathematics. There are issues of how should one sample and what resolution should one get. But I think where the mathematicians may be able to contribute is in the wave propagation. A lot of these questions. I'm hoping that mathematicians would be able to contribute to a lot of these issues. That's not to say that the engineers can't do it, but mathematicians come at this at problems from a little bit different point of view, and I think that may be useful.
Engineers often say mathematicians that we mathematicians are like Frenchmen.
Right, we translate into something altogether different. Right.
This philosophical discussion, you cannot do it personally.
I just wonder what you think we should do to actually make sure that the work we do has an impact on the engineers.
Well, I think it's important to be talking to the engineers and reading the engineering literature to make sure that we're working on relevant problems.
Well, it seems like I'm the only engineer here.
And
that happens to be heavily electrical engineering. I mean, the things that you are talking about, so we have a standard course in antenna design and antenna. All these things are covered. And if the community doesn't mind my comments here, to us engineers, often the mathematical literature is very hard to read. I mean, we can't figure things out reading the mathematical literature. And so that's the reason I come to our mathematical colleagues is to explain things what you are trying to say, so I can use it, whether I need to use it, and especially like for my work, optimization techniques. If I read any mathematical literature, I cannot make any sense out of it. Mm-hmm. But the same mm-hmm. material, if I read it into any electrical engineering or biomedical imaging journals, they make sense. And mm-hmm. so what you could do for us would be is teach us in a better way how to add 1 plus 1 is equal to 2.
Yeah, I agree that there's a big communication gap between these two communities. Even though they're working on the same problems, the communities often can't talk to each other. So one of my goals here, you know, I've been spending a lot of time trying to read the engineering literature, and I agree that what I'm presenting is nothing new to the engineering community, but mathematicians trying to read that same literature have a very hard time because it's, you know, it always seems that the engineers are starting sort of in the middle of the problem. And so what I'm trying to do is trying to explain things in a way that I hope the math community will be able to understand and maybe be able, start being able to contribute to this. And then when the math community does do something useful, then it's important to be able to translate, to write it, you know, explain it in a simple way without using a lot of the fancy machinery and so forth that only mathematicians learn. So
we'll leave that problem.
Right. Okay.
On that positive note, let's thank you very much. Okay.
We will continue in 5 minutes. 25 to 11, we're a little bit late, but that's okay.